Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Greatest Games on Football Ramble Daily in association with the Blizzard.
Danielson. Ja voimakkaasti hän tulee sisään, kompuroi pallon kanssa, nappaa sen sitten itselleen. Ja nyt on varma paikka ja siinä on maali ja siinä on myöskin ratkaisu. Bebeto maalintekijänä, Turen Flo, Junior Bajano. Ja nyt on Flolla paikka ja Norja tulee otteluun mukaan. 37,5 minuuttia pelattu ja hieno maali. Turen Flo kaatuu sen Junior Bajano käsittelyssä. Ja rankkariako näyttää ottelun edotuomari. Tuleeko tästä Norjalle 2?
Today we have Norway's finest Lars Sivertsen with us. It's a pleasure to have you with us. Lars, Jonathan Wilson, of course, is sat opposite me. Today we're looking at we're going to the 1998 World Cup in France. It's the first round. Norway, they need to beat Brazil to go through. It seems unlikely when you look at the talent in the Brazil side. Why have you chosen this game, Lars?
I've chosen it. Well, the obvious reason is it's been voted, I believe, something like the greatest sporting moment in my country's history.
Sure.
Certainly it topped some sort of book that was done recently of top 100 biggest moments. And it's one of those moments where everyone knows exactly where they were and what they were doing.
What was second?
That have to Norway be to England, something to do
surely.
With skis, one would imagine. No, but more crucially, because for me it represented like the peak of the Egil Olsen years. I mean, this sort of mad period in footballing history where at one point we were on second in the FIFA rankings. You know, half the Premier League seemed to be Norwegians. You know, it was a very strange time.
Norway was second in the rankings.
Yes,
that was a bit earlier. So
yeah,
that,
well, around 95, I think thereabouts.
Okay.
Might be even earlier. But yeah, no,
they have changed the algorithm since.
But we had some incredible results. But in tournaments, you know, 94 was a little bit disappointing. In the tournament results, the players themselves feel that way, certainly.
Because they went out in the first round on goals scored?
On fewer goals scored. Every team in the group ended up on 4 points.
So that was that
madness.
Crazy group with Ireland and
really
Italy.
Bizarre
Mexico,
stuff, yeah.
Mexico.
And Ireland and Italy.
And they felt they hadn't done there as well as they could have done. And in 98, it looked like it was going the same way. Because we drew 2-2 against Morocco, and then we drew against Scotland. And we thought, oh, good Lord, you know.
Well, and failed to qualify for 96 as well.
Yeah, out of a very good group. We can talk about that later, but it looked at that point as if it was going to ebb away. Some of the players were getting old. Like the whole Egil Olsen thing, it's had its moments, and they weren't going to have this one big transcendental moment that we could all identify with it. And then they had just at the end of it.
Well, this was their time, as you say. I mean, you look at Norway's size, this was their kind of, dare I say, golden generation.
Yes.
And to put in context, first round, as you say, Brazil have already qualified. Six points, as you'd expect. Scotland and Morocco played, and both sides needed to win to have a chance of going through. And of course, Norway.
Yes, Brazil on 6 points, yes. Norway on two, mm-hmm. Scotland and Morocco on one each.
Yeah, and as it would turn out, Morocco hammered Scotland 3-0.
Yeah.
And obviously the goals are going in. Norway very, very aware of what's going on. They're playing the mighty Brazil. Yes, they've already qualified, but this Brazil side, Ronaldo, you know, Cafu was in there, was he? Taffarel in goal, Dunga. You know, the names roll off the tongue. And Bebeto as well was playing up front, of course.
Yeah,
and
they'd made two changes, I think.
So it was pretty much full strength.
And the players knew that Morocco were beating Scotland as well.
Yes.
So half-time was 1-0, wasn't it? So this game was 0-0
at half-time. It was communicated to them that Morocco were 2-0 up. They certainly said after the game that they knew Morocco
were... And then Morocco went too early in the second half.
Yes, 46 minutes or something. And they said after the game that they knew Morocco were winning. And so when Brazil then scored in the 78th minute, I believe it was, they all said after the game, like, we thought we were done.
And of course, you would have thought so. You think to yourself, "Oh, there we go. That's done and dusted."
And it was Bebeto who got the goal back post. Awful marking. Bebeto completely unmarked.
Uncharacteristically bad. And actually, this whole championship was dogged by bad defending by Norwegians. I mean, the Craig Burley goal for Scotland was a simple ball over the top. The 2-1 goal for Morocco was a simple ball over the top that didn't defend. So uncharacteristically bad at the back. So then conceding in that way against Brazil was desperate. And Egil Olsen said after the game, "I don't usually believe in Santa." So at that point, I said my goodbyes to the World Cup.
So going into the game, we already mentioned that Norway drew with Morocco and drew with Scotland. They would have wanted at least one win. At least one win.
Absolutely.
You know, you're probably looking realistically maybe 4 points from those two games. They've got 2 points. What was the mood then like among the Norwegian fans going into that Brazil game? Presumably they thought, we've probably let our chance go.
Yeah, there was a lot of frustration because this was a better team than a 94 team, I think most people felt, because they still had the core of that group, whereas we now had Tor Andre Flo up front, who was very promising, a very good striker. And there had been some kerfuffle off the pitch. Henny Berg and Erik Mykland went out on the town after the Morocco game, which hadn't gone down well with anyone. So there was a lot of controversy there. And it's also, they'd been so good in the qualifiers. I mean, they were in a slightly easier group in the qualifiers because they'd shot up the rankings, but they won 6 games and drawn twice and not lost any game, only conceding 2 goals in all of qualifying. So going into the tournament, there was a sense that, no, I'm not think we're going to win the World Cup or something mad like that, but we're certainly going to do better than in the US.
You get past the first round.
Exactly, yeah, right. So when you then slip up against Morocco, you slip up against Scotland, and you then have to play Brazil, it's a very frustrating
situation
situation to be in, because you realistically it's not going to happen. And then you start thinking, actually, maybe this was it, because a lot of the key players are getting on a bit, and it had to be then.
So how did the enigmatic Egil Olsen set up against Brazil? What was his approach different to this game?
Well, this is another sort of subplot here, is that it was a big point of pride for Olsen, because he was not just a guy who was very confident in his way of playing, but he was evangelical about it. It wasn't just that this is the way I do it. He was quite clear that everyone else is doing everything wrong. and it was very clear that Brazil would be a much better team if they played more like Egil Olsen's Norway.
And everyone should be wearing Wellington boots.
No, for sure. And he felt very strongly about this. So for him, it mattered even more. And the key, I mean, we can talk a bit about Olsen's philosophy. I think this is important because it's a big part of the story, is that he's seen as this sort of long ball hoof merchant, and that is part of it. But when I interviewed him for the Blizzard, obviously, I mean, I've asked him to sort of describe his philosophy. And what he said is that it's all about exploiting the opponents when they're out of balance. It's about attacking quickly. When the opponent is off balance, they shouldn't be allowed to regain it. So you attack very quickly. Obviously, a long ball is a way to do that, but it's more about getting forwards quickly.
It's a sort of proto gegenpressing, isn't it?
In a bit of a way, yeah. Except the crucial difference is that he didn't necessarily believe in high press. He thought that was too risky. So he thought the thing was to sit back and interrupt them further back, but then attack very, very quickly.
It was counterattacking, really.
It was, and it was extraordinarily direct. I mean,
so you wouldn't press at all, would you not?
Occasionally they'd press higher up, but it was something that worried him. I mean, he would do it occasionally, but instinctively, he felt it was very risky, and not in the sort of gung-ho way. He would pack the bag. I mean, there's an urban legend. I asked him about it in one of his earlier club teams. There's a story that apparently in training, in pre-season training, when they were playing, every time someone would play a square ball, he'd just stop it and just give them a ball king. It was like any sideways passes, or heavens forbid, backwards passes, he would stop proceedings immediately and tell them to stop doing this.
Because the reason I find that slightly surprising is that, you know, I sort of think of Olsen and Graham Taylor as being the two sort of maybe most successful managers who are linked with Charles Reap.
Yeah.
And you know, Charles Reap, if anybody doesn't know who he is slightly odd former RAF officer who in the mid-50s decided to start taking very detailed statistical notes on Swindon Town's performances, would sit in the stand at the county ground wearing a miner's helmet so he could see his notebook with a lamp on the front, and would whatever oddities he subsequently came up with, he was one of the very first people, one of the great pioneers of trying to work out a way of statistically breaking a game down. And for that, I think you have to give him great credit. But Graham Taylor's basic idea, you know, he said, you know, it wasn't some sort of well thought out philosophical notion how you should play football. He just sort of thought, well, the last 10 minutes of games when you're chasing a goal, what do? You whack the ball in the corner and everybody chases it and you try and get it back. So he started doing that for 90 minutes. And it took Watford, you know, between 1977 and 1982, took them to three promotions and took them to second in the table. And each level they went up, he kept on expecting to be found out. And so Reap's, the thing that he became obsessed by was what he called reaches, which was when you could regain possession in the final third. So that came either through a long ball and a knockdown and you pick it up, or in Taylor's case, you pen the opposition back.
Almost pressing, but, really.
It is pressing. Yeah. It's absolutely what it is. Yeah. It is pressing. And your Liverpool and Nottingham Forest were doing a more sophisticated version of it, but they would press. And yeah, Jurgen Klopp now, he's, you know, he says that he's been very influenced by the Schwabian school of managers and Rangnick and all that. You know, the Liverpool of the late 70s was, yeah, the team he grew up watching and wanting to play like, that sort of great aggression with control. Mm-hmm. Taylor's team wouldn't have a control afterwards. They wouldn't have a technical capacity on the ball. But the idea of winning the ball back high up a pitch to catch the opponent before they're set. Mm-hmm. So I just sort of assumed that Olsen was also kind of pursuing this sort of double strategy.
Yeah, it's slightly misleading of me to say that he would always sit back. But he was, I mean, if we compare to proper like high-pressing sort of madmen like Bielsa and this sort of thing, like he wouldn't go that far.
Yeah, well, sure.
He was a pretty risk-averse dude. Yeah. And the other facet of this is that Norway ended up deep quite often just because they always tried to hit the high-risk pass immediately when they won the ball, because they were told to get it forward as quickly as possible. As a result of that, they didn't have much possession. As a result of that, you get pushed back a lot. So, I mean, that would often happen.
I mean, was he also utilising the size of some of the players? I mean, sorry, Andre Flo, you know, what was he, 6'4", 6'5", something like
that? Yeah, and
that.
That's,
you
know, not, I mean, he's very closely associated with the concept of the flow pass, which is a sort of long, booming diagonal across to a tall player out wide. And this is something he came up with in a friendly against Portugal in, I think it was 19...
That Olsen came up with.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I believe it was 1993. I mean,
he's trying to utilise flow like, you know, Niall Quinn was utilised, you know, that kind of ball into the leggy front man, if you can try and get it under.
Niall Quinn had great chest control. Yeah. Great volley of football.
We've all got our influences.
Having seen both of them play for Sunderland, I would definitely take Quinn every day. But.
I appreciate that's excellent covering, guys. I was looking through my notes. as the astute listeners will have noticed. No, it was a 1993 friendly against Portugal, according to himself, where he decided to play Jostein Flo in a slightly wider position, partially because he had identified that the Portuguese fullbacks were a bit on the short side. And, I mean, they didn't win the game, but for the equal 1-1 goal, there was a big hoof from the right back over to Flo, who was out on the left there, who just smashed the full back in the aerial duel, and then the following knockdown a goal ensued, and it's something he did quite a lot.
That was before they beat England 2-0, because it was that long diagonal which
I'm sure that will have happened there as well, but that's the example he cited himself.
Well, because
we have produced a good number of strong centre forwards, so if you want them on the pitch, you end up putting them out wide.
Because Graham Taylor was so terrified by was it Jostein? It would have been Jostein.
Yeah, he was the tallest.
Coming in off the left, that he played a back three with Gary Pallister as right wing back. Yeah. And Olsen outwitted him by playing Flew on the
Gary
right
Pallister
instead of the left.
A wing back.
Yeah.
It didn't work.
No, I could have told you. I could have told him that before, didn't he? My goodness. So Olsen, I mean, yeah, sets up Norway against Brazil. I mean, how would he use Øyvind Leonardsen? Because Leonardsen's slightly different.
Well, he would run a lot, and he was emblematic of what Norway would do, because it was a lot of... because you play so extremely direct, crazily direct, you end up losing the ball a lot and you end up out of possession a lot. And then, since pressing and zonal pressing is very important, you need midfielders who can run.
So Leonardsen had a lot to
Leonardsen famously ran more than anyone, and we learned a lot as a child, because I'm a child of this generation. As you're young, you learn like he's very good because he runs. The phrase was he's best in ball, he's best without the ball. Sounds bad in English, but it doesn't mean you're terrible on the ball, but it means you're very good when it comes to where to run and how to run and to never go up. Now, famously, in the Brazil game, Leonardsen vomited at halftime, something that wasn't unusual. The then team doctor, Trygve Casa, said that when Leo vomits at halftime, he's in top shape. It is a good sign, not unhealthy, and just proof that he's very good at giving his all.
Excellent.
So that was routine that Leonardsen would vomit at halftime.
So the vomiting was from effort, it wasn't from nerves, something like that.
Well, I think what Leo said himself was that the suggestion is that... His body reacted badly to relaxing again, because natural state was herring about the pitch like a madman. So when you get in at half time and you sit down, the body would then vomit, I guess.
Football's a very vomity sport, isn't it? I mean, Zidane and Messi have both had famous vomits, haven't they?
Yeah. But speaking of zonal pressing, I mean, it's worth mentioning, since we've already mentioned Charles Reap, Egil Olsen's other big source of inspiration is also an Englishman, is George Curtis, who I believe was an inside forward for Southampton in his day, played for Arsenal, and would later coach Brighton and Hove Albion and the San Diego Toros over in America. But he coached Rosenborg he took over in 1969, and they won the league the first season, but he was received some criticism because it was quite defensive and the club weren't happy with that, so he was told to buck up his idea and attack a little bit more. And in the second season they finished second with their goal differences. In 18 games they scored 15 but conceded only 5. So if you've been told by the club to attack a bit more, scoring 15 goals in 18 games is not ideal. So Curtis was sacked. Later on, he took over as the national team coach of Norway, which was quite dreadful. I mean, he was something. It was 17 games. I think they won 3 times. Two of those were against Iceland, and one was against North Korea. I mean, in terms of results, it was a pretty dreadful reign. I think they lost against Luxembourg as well in this period. So it wasn't ideal. So most sane people will look at that and think that's not great, but. But not so a young Egil Olsen.
Absolutely.
He had spotted something he liked. And to be fair, Curtis introduced the concept of the flat back four and zonal marking rather than following the ball.
So I don't suppose, you know, did Curtis come through that Alan Wade training course and later, because the first sort of proper
training course he was on, I can't tell you, Jonathan.
No, this was a hugely influential. Alan Wade sort of wrote this great textbook of how to play football. He was certainly the first English coach to try and break the game down into all its component phases and to teach the way of doing it. And he in the late 60s, he instituted this course through the FA, which Roy Hodgson was on. Bobby Houghton was on, because they both went on to have great success in Sweden before everything else. I think Ron Greenwood might even come through
it
that.
It sounds exceedingly likely that he was part of this, or certainly inspired by the similar ideas. Yeah,
the flat back four, the zonal marking midfield.
Yeah.
All of that is very Alan Wade.
Yeah, and even if the results in Norway were not amazing, it was something Egil Olsen said again to the Blizzard that it really took him aback. And like, the idea that you shouldn't bother with the opposition, but you should position yourself according to your teammates in defence, that was just a completely different way of thinking, and I was fascinated by it. It's something that Olsen talks about now. Since we beat England and kept you from qualifying for the American 94 World Cup, the two big sort of sources of inspiration for that were Englishmen.
Well, and from Graham Taylor's point of view,
the
an
same
English,
as a lot
an
of
Englishmen who played a very similar style.
but just
better.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com. A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Referees let him go on, and Bebeto scores! Well, that was extraordinary because it looked as though the referee was going to give Brazil a free kick. By not doing that, he's allowed them the goal from Bebeto. 12 minutes to go.
You mentioned that this generation of Norwegian players was your generation growing up. It was mine as well. And sometimes when, certainly years after that, you could look at Norway and go, but they're meant to be a good side. They're really in the doldrums. But no, that was a bit of a peak time, as we've mentioned before. So back to the game itself. As we said, it's 0-0 at half time. Morocco, what are they, 1-0 up against Scotland? Then Morocco score 2-0 and Norway are down. What's Olsen doing then? What's the mood in the Norwegian side? Because when all said and done, they are playing a superior side who went on to reach the final, who were the world champions. You know, if you commit too much in attack, you're going to get punished. And they did go 1-0 down in the 78th minute from a Bebeto header.
Egil Olsen is, for all of his strengths as a manager, he's not a huge believer in changing things in-game. I mean, that's partially because he has his way of playing and he believes in it 100%. I'm pretty sure he's on record saying that once the game kicks off, there's not that much you can do from the bench, which I think there are some coaches that might disagree with that, but he has said that. And he made three subs, and they were basically like for like. And the first sub came at halftime, where he took out Roastrand. Now Roastrand played for Rosenborg. You could argue that having him and Ivan Leonardsen in the same midfield is a bit of a muchness, even if I think he played out on the wing in this game, because Roastrand was another one of those who would run all day and then run some more, and that was his main quality as a footballer. Not to say that he wasn't decent technically. He played many games for Rosenborg in the Champions League, but he was the extraordinary lung power of this man. That was his great thing. He was taken off at halftime because
he didn't vomit.
Well, maybe not, but presumably at halftime, Olsen will have heard that the Moroccans were ahead, so you needed to attack a little bit more in the second half. So he introduced the Erik Mykland, who was a sort of just a magnificent player in the sense that he was quite short, long hair. I mean, his nickname was Myggen, which is sounds like Mykland. Myggen is Norwegian for the mosquito, so it was quite literally would buzz around, and a very technical, good balance, good vision. Not an Egil Olsen type player at all, but someone who was a valued member of that group by Olsen, because he could recognise that he brought a bit of creativity. And Egil Olsen, for all of his dogmatic stubbornness, he was always a manager who appreciated players who had extraordinary sort of, if you had a spisfeldighet in Norwegian, if you have one thing that you can do that you're a lot better at than anyone else, he saw the value in that, because I think he understood, as Norway, when we're playing teams internationally, most of their players will be better at us at most things. So if we have individuals who are very good at something, that's
what's the word in Norwegian?
Spisfeldighet.
And what's the literal translation of that?
Spis means sharp, means the tip of something, and feldighet means skill.
Okay.
So yes, yeah, sometimes. Mm. So you could say like Peter Crouch would have a Spitzfeldt head because mm-hmm. he's just very tall.
Yeah.
You can say there was a later. I mean, Daniel Broughton, who's a bit of a joke figure here, from an ill-fated spell at Bolton, but he was a player who in Olsen's second spell in Norway had a bit of a resurgence at international level because he was a player who didn't like running so much, but he was very strong and very technical with the ball. So if you gave him the ball, he could do a lot of damage. I mean, slightly idiosyncratic players. Players who are very, if you think at like FIFA or football managers, sure, players who have very high numbers
just
for one of two specific things.
Uh-huh.
And you can, so he valued, even though Mikkelsen wasn't a Leonardsen, he was very highly valued by Egil Olsen, and he put him on to add a bit of creativity.
Do you feel that had the desired effect?
It helps, but I think the goals, when they eventually came, it was from a long hoof up the side to Tor-André Flo, the equaliser came. So, I mean, I guess...
So, the equaliser comes, 83 minutes?
Yeah.
The better's put Brazil ahead, 78, and 83 mm-hmm. minutes. Stigging a
Bjørneby. Very good.
He's left in loads of space.
Yes,
and
absolutely.
It's only occurred to me, actually, mm-hmm. This was, in a sense, Brazil... Although they're obviously a very good side, reigning world champions, from a tactical point of view, they were almost the perfect team for Norway to play against.
Yeah. Yeah.
In that, they sort of played that column down the middle, the 4-2-2-2.
Which they've played in a few tournaments.
And so there's no real way of them to put pressure on the fullbacks. So, yeah, they had Bebeto and Ronaldo in the middle up front, and then behind them, they had Rivaldo and Danilson. I guess Danilson could pull left.
Yeah, he would,
as he did for the goal. Better goal.
Yeah,
but there's no pressure on Bjørnbu.
Because you're relying on the fullbacks to play.
And when you know long balls from fullback is what Norway does a lot of the time, yeah. Anyway. If this had been a quarterfinal or something, one imagines that perhaps the Brazilians would have done some homework on this. But I guess there was no real need for it under circumstances.
Not necessarily. But that goal, as you say, it was perfect. Olsen
booms it down
stuff.
Down the channel.
Mm-hmm.
Tor-André Flo against Junior Baiano gets a little bit lucky that he obviously out-muscles him, but then the ball sort of bobbles.
Wait, he turns inside.
He rides his
which frankly Baiano maybe should have not allowed.
Well,
that
he turns inside, the ball bounces off Baiano back into his path.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it's a beautiful finish.
Flo in a trial of strength with Junior Baiano, and Tor-André Flo has struck back for Norway, all his own work. A very fine goal from a very fine player.
But that is, I guess, when we're comparing to 94, and I keep bringing it back to it because I think it does matter a little bit. I mean, that's the little bit of cutting edge up front that we didn't really have in 94. I mean, God bless Jan Åge Fjørtoft, but he wasn't, you know, quite as good as Tor-André Flo.
From Flo's point of view, or any striker's point of view, it's a great goal.
Yeah, no.
It gets them.
It's a terrific goal. And it's worth noting that Tor-André Flo did not have good games earlier in the tournament, and he said that he'd been very frustrated and that he'd been trying too hard, essentially, he said after the game, and he felt... A lot of other coaches would have dropped him because we had a young Ole Gunnar Solskjaer there, you know.
Who came off the bench midway through the second half.
Håvard Flo could play up front. Jostein Flo was a unit. But instead of dropping him, Olsen kept faith with him. Not only that, Olsen told him specifically to relax more. I mean, you have a misfiring forward who hasn't done anything much in the first two games. And instead of trying him to try harder, Olsen told him very specifically, whenever there's a drop in play, just relax, let your shoulders down. You know, relax, you're trying too hard. And then right at, like, he has 10 minutes left to influence this competition in some way, Tor-André Flo, and he scores a great goal.
Yeah.
And by this point, there's Tor-André Flo, Jostein Flo, and Solskjaer all on the pitch.
Against Brazil.
Can't quite work out how that works tactically. And I can't work out what you could possibly do other than lump the ball long in the box and hope for the best.
Yeah. But
thankfully, that's what they were doing anyway.
Exactly.
Well, it can work. It can work.
Well, you do it by playing two of the strikers out wide. But this was an issue for us. Even in our heyday, we produced very decent number nines, but maybe not that many rapid, skillful wingers. Mm. So you ended up a lot of times, even if it was a stratagem from Olsen's perspective to have a tall number nine out wide, because fullbacks usually can't deal with that. Mm-hmm. It also was very convenient for us to, in a way, to get more than one of these strikers into the team.
And that last 10 minutes, Norway absolutely battered.
And they did.
So Flo has a headed chance, he puts just wide, then there's another long ball from Bjørneby that is knocked down, and Flo at the back post, I mean, really should score, but
sort
of pushes his shot slightly wide. And you see that he thinks that was a chance, he goes down his knees, and there's a real look of, I'm going to be thinking about that for the rest of my life, time I could have put us through against Brazil. And then 89th minute,
the penalty.
It's wrecked up. It's 2-1 to Norway. An extraordinary turnaround. And how the man with the yellow boots has hurt those wearing the yellow shirts. Delight for Egil Olsen.
And it's one of those... It's a
controversial one.
It's a soft penalty on the first, second and third viewing.
Yeah.
And it wasn't actually until the next day when footage emerged.
That's right, I remember
this
that.
This is really fascinating.
I remember that vividly.
We just had that argument before you got here.
Well, because I remember when...
I was saying it was soft and then Marcus was sort of, oh no, there's footage of it, really.
I was living in Scotland at the time and the Scots felt very sorry for the Moroccans.
Yeah.
Because you know they've been humbled by Morocco, and Morocco, you know,
were
celebrating.
A really good team.
They were celebrating pretty much after the game as they should, and then suddenly the news filtered through, and everyone thought, "Hang on a minute! Oh, it was a dodgy penalty. No way! What a load of nonsense!" But then the footage came the next day.
The next day, because we see the replays, and it looks like basically a bit of a dive, like he just sort of falls down. But the referee.
It's Toi Andrefo and Gini Bayano again.
Yeah, again, but the referee was very, very clear.
I was thinking, I'm not letting him get away from me this time.
Yeah, and the next day, footage emerged. Taken from another camera behind the goal.
Was it from Norwegian
TV? I think
TV?
It was Swedish TV. And I'm not sure it was actually part of the match day coverage.
I don't think it was.
For like B-roll for documentary stuff.
Set
or whatever.
Up in a studio.
Yeah.
And the good old Swedes came to.
And they did. And from that angle, you could see that Bayano had just given his shirt a big old tug, and it was standing out like some sort of sail on a boat. You know, it was. And it would have been. I mean, in the days of VAR, obviously it would be picked up straight away. But back then, there was a real
risk.
The
referee, who was the American Esfandiar Bahamast, is very clear. You know, he's sort of clenching his fist and pulling down, and there's a little smile on his face as well.
He's delighted, like, I know I made a good call here.
But, well, I have to say that was what made me suspicious when I first saw it. Oh, there's a man who likes being the centre of attention. There's the American Mike Dean.
I think it was obviously. I would say that. I think it's a great call.
I haven't seen.
And it was.
Footage,
it was actually later. It was put in Referee magazine. They made a list of top refereeing decisions in football history, and they had it right near the top of the list. I think.
This is a Norwegian.
It's incredible. No, absolutely not. Yeah. It's a great call.
The nerves of steel.
Yeah, and this is Kjetil Rekdal. I mean, if it's up to me, you can talk about him for the rest of the running hour. He's a really fascinating figure, because Kjetil Rekdal, who took the penalty, he's a very un-Norwegian character. You know, Norwegians in football, as in rest of life, we're all about like, try your best and be a good teammate, you know, and this sort of thing. Rekdal is a winner. He has a winning mentality. He doesn't care if you've tried your best if you don't get a result at the end of it. Famously, I do apologize to him if I'm misremembering this anecdote, but he was rooming with Jostein Flo when they drew away to England, and he scored himself.
He's got the equalizer,
a magnificent long-range shot. And he got up to the room afterwards, and Jostein was like having a bear and like feeling delighted with himself, and he asked, "What are you celebrating, mate?" And it's like, "No, we've drawn against England. It's a good result." And it's like, "You only came on for the last 15 minutes. Like, sod off and celebrate with the fans. Like, you've got nothing to be happy about." Like, he was that kind of guy, which is very un-Norwegian. And I think again, Egil Olsen, appreciating people who brought something slightly extreme to the party, loved the fact that he had the sort of that drive and that level. I mean, he must be a nightmare a tricky guy to have on your team sometimes, I'm sure.
So when you saw him step up to take the penalty, because I'd imagine you were quite nervous at the time.
Well, I was very young at the time, so I didn't know any of this. If I was older and I knew more about it, because I was like, I've been 11 years old or something. So for me, I was just freaked out about a great number of things, as you are at 11. But in hindsight, he was the perfect guy for it. And incredibly, he insists that he had a premonition earlier that day.
That's right, yeah. He dreamt the night before, was it?
What he said, that might be, what he said recently was that he was rooming with Solskjaer then, which is great for young Solskjaer, I'm sure. And he had a premonition that they were going to get a penalty and that he'd need to score it for Norway to go through, and that he would score it. And he was in the room trying to read Le Keep, because he didn't speak much French. He was playing in France, and he was trying to read the keep, and suddenly he had this epiphany that we're going to get a penalty and I'm going to have to score it to go through, and I will score it. And he told Solskjaer, and he was like, good. good for you, Kjetil.
So it came to pass. I mean,
it's a great penalty.
He smashes it right into the corner of that, and the scenes of celebration, and Norway go through.
Yeah.
Incredible. And it seemed just such an unlikely result.
And it's a good penalty in the sense that, and this is another thing Kjetil says, he's uncle uncle that taught him a lot about playing football when he was a kid, and he always said the most important thing is that you hit the thing you're aiming for in football, which I guess is true a lot of the time, whether you're shooting or passing, you just hit the thing you're aiming for. And he went up to the penalty thinking, for the penalties, you know, if you hit it cleanly and you hit it well and it goes what you're aiming for, the goalkeeper isn't going to save it. Like, this is in the nature of penalties. So he was very confident. He insists, I think he said something like, I had the lowest heart rate of any Norwegian, because he insists I was very calm. Now, some of that might be bluster, but he always seemed like, as the commentary on the night says, it says, Recht, all han kalsom en fisk. He's cold like a fish, the commentator said, as he stepped up to take it. And he did. He scored it past Taffarel, who went the right way. Yep. It's a very well-struck penalty.
It was. And it's, you know, you said it was the greatest moment voted in Norway sporting history. It's certainly, and they're through default, it's the greatest result in the Norwegian men's national team.
Yeah, because as much that this was a team that had brought everyone a lot of joy. Like, they'd beaten a lot of big teams, some of them in friendlies, but some of them in competitive matches as well. You know, beating England, beating Holland, qualifying for the World Cup. But they hadn't had maybe like one moment that you could look back on and think like that was the moment, the sort of great sort of transcendental moment that everyone remembers, everyone knows where they were. And like I said, time was taken away a little bit, and you know, maybe they would go on to still be good, but you never know that. And they had a chance, and they ended up doing it quite remarkably.
Yeah, I mean, sadly they lost to Italy in the next round, but I mean a very good Italian side.
Frustrating game again, though. That had shades of the US tournament in the sense that it was quite hot and they didn't enjoy that, and everyone came away from that game feeling that if they'd played their best, you know, they could have caused them more trouble. And again, I think there were some, everyone's really reverent of Egil Olsen, as they should be. He's done an extraordinary amount of great things for the country. But I think for some of the slightly better footballers in the group, they always felt that if the handbrake was taken off a little bit more and they were allowed to play the ball a little bit more, perhaps there's some games they could have gotten more. But that's after the fact anyway. They went out. That was the end of it.
Yeah, and as you say, it was not too realistic to think Norway could go all the way. But the fact is they had that amazing result, a real marquee result, which will go down.
Tell us about the opera.
Well, there was an opera in the, it was 2011 or some such, which was a footballing opera written by a author and satirist who wanted to write an opera about football so he could appeal to both people who don't like opera and people who don't like football and just get them all on board. And it was about how people, it has a recreation of the game in it, of course, where this thing of rectal being cold like a fish is expanded on in a song. I think he is compared to a haddock or some such. I mean, I think that is the fish in question, but also about how people watching this
fish, famously. Yeah.
Yeah, DJ.
You want a fish to take a penalty, choose a haddock.
The opera also goes into how the moment affected the people who watched it. I mean, they were inspired to go out and become a better version of themselves, because if you can beat Brazil, then anything can happen. And I mean, it was unseasonably hot. I mean, it was the middle of summer, but for Norway, it was unusually hot. So there were almost like street parties in Oslo, which is not something you see very often. I mean, it kicked off in a big way in Oslo, I'm told. I wasn't there. And when you talk to people, they have like, I worked with a photographer a couple of years ago who said something about she'd been on a remote island in Indonesia and they had to take a boat for an hour to get to the next island because they had a TV there. Like, everyone has this sort of story of where they were when they saw this game. It's a great sort of, we talk about football as a tool for nation building and creating unity. I mean, this is a great example of that.
Absolutely. Well,
I was in Scarborough myself.
Yeah.
Obviously.
Where better to be. I mean, of course. Lars, it's been fantastic to unpack that and what an important moment for Norway, but also a great game and a great result in sort of modern World Cup history, you could say. A great upset as well. Lars, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Pleasure. Jonathan, as thank always you. A pleasure. Thank you, everybody. We'll see you next time. That was the Greatest Games on Football Ramble Daily in association with The Blizzard. We're back next week with another classic game, so do not miss it. See you soon.
This was a Stakhanov production.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.